Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Valentine's Day is just around the corner when thoughts turn to love, but there are different kinds of love, and today we celebrate that with books on love. Animal love, soup love, city love, doll love, and yes, of course, some romantic love too. Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library, and Melanie Lowers, books editor at the Cape Cod Times, join us with their picks. Good morning.
Good morning,
Mindy.
Good
morning.
We've got, again, quite an array here in front of us. And first, Jill, because this is a program about books and we love books, let's start with book love.
And may I just say, we could do the entire show on books about book love. It's surprising how many books are written about the passion for books. This one is called My Bookstore. It's not just the passion for books themselves, but the places where people buy books and look for books. It's called My Bookstore. Writers celebrate their favorite places to browse, read, and shop. Edited by Ronald Rice and booksellers across America. With an intro by Richard Russo, and he has a really funny little paragraph at the beginning about why he loves books and bookstores. He says, "I'm an old fart, of course, more at home with paper and print than touchscreens. And yes, I agree with those who argue that in the end, it's more about the message of books than the medium of their delivery. A good book read on an electronic device is better than a bad one between hard covers. But to me, bookstores like my first one remain places of genuine wonder. They fill me with both pride and humility when I come upon my own books in them. Bookstores, like libraries, are the physical manifestation of the wide world's longest, best, most thrilling conversation. The people who work in them will tell you who's saying what. If you ask, they'll tell you what Richard Russo's up to in his new one. But more important, they'll put in your hands something you just have to read by someone you've never heard of, someone just now entering the conversation who wants to talk to you about things that matter. If you haven't been in a good bookstore in a while, the book you now hold in your hand will welcome you lovingly home."
I love him, by the way.
Richard Russo,
oh,
yes.
He's
yes.
Awesome.
And one of the delightful things about this particular book on bookstores is, first of all, there are 9 bookstores from Massachusetts are in this book, and they include Nantucket Bookworks. Ellen Hildebrand writes an article about Nantucket Bookworks. Ward Just writes about the Bunch of Grapes bookstore on the Vineyard. And Nancy Thayer writes about Mitchell's Book Corner on Nantucket. And I have to say, I know all about falling in love with bookstores because when I first moved to Falmouth, I fell in love with the Market Bookshop. I mean, I got off the bus for the interview, and I was, and you, of course, then you had to walk past the bookstore.
It was like a magnet.
It was just, I was like, I must get this job because I want to go to this bookstore. Alas, it is no longer
there.
But
yeah,
we do have other lovely bookstores. It is really an amazing pull when you really love. And it, just as he says, it's one of those loves that is so strong. And you are so grateful for anyone who can tell you your next good book to read.
Right.
And that was actually one of the great things about the Market Bookshop as well, is that they did great reader's advisory. Mm-hmm. Absolutely spectacular. So in any way, this section by Ellen Hildebrand ends saying, "I am not a political person. I have never campaigned for anyone. I have never marched on Washington. I don't care if you return your cart to the front of the supermarket or leave it to block the parking spot for the next person. I don't care if you buy a tomato out of season or dismiss organic milk as too expensive. But I would implore you to buy your books from independently owned bookstores. Places like Nantucket Bookworks and people like Dick Burns have a quality that is hard to find in the world today. They are authentic. They make the world safe for budding writers on 10-speed bikes with big dreams."
Mm,
so
nice.
The love of bookstores is strong.
All right. And then, Melanie, we're going to go a little bit into the time machine here.
Oh, yes,
back to
are.
The book that stirred your childhood heart.
Well, you know what? I doubt if most people can pinpoint, you know, the first time they realized that what romantic love was, or what the power of romantic love is, you know, in fiction or in any other medium. But in fact, this book is called Mystery House, and the author's name is Kathleen Norris, and it was published in 1935. And somewhere around my mother's 12th or 13th birthday, she read this book. And I know this because her old address is, and her name is in the front of the book, in handwriting that I so remember. And she gave me this book or allowed me to read it at some point. And I was immediately gathered into it. And I've never forgotten it. And it's a story that you've probably seen in bad books a thousand times. A young woman is brought to an island as a caretaker for an older woman. And she's told to stay out of one part of the house. And of course, it's an isolated place. It's a craggy building. It's perpetually bad weather. You know, her name is Paige, which I decided I was going to name my daughter Paige because I so love this character. And of course, there's a mystery character in the book, and his name is Lynn. And she is told that Lynn is violent and must be medicated to keep his strange animal propensities under control. But it turns out that, in fact, he's been drugged because there is evil afoot. And of course, she finds out about this and she rescues him and they fall in love. So everything is in here. It is the original Dark and Stormy Night. And yet, when I was 12 or 13 years old, when I read this for the first time, it had such a huge impact on me. First of all, I fell in love with Lynn, with Paige, and with the whole sort of sense that you could drive emotions through text and through a couple of well-chosen, very dark, noir-looking photos or illustrations. And you know, it's not a good book. Don't get me wrong. Although if you Google Kathleen Norris, you'll find her. And they talk about she was a popular novelist, that kind of thing. But really what was important about this was that it functioned like all other romantic literature in which, despite yourself, you get caught up in these things, especially the really, really best ones. Now, I went on to read a lot of really good ones, you know, the classic ones, the Brontes, the Austens, you know, and on and on and on, and many other wide, wide variety of romantic literature and romantic poetry, real romance writers, the real stuff. And but I've never forgotten Mystery House because it set the tone for everything that came afterwards. And if you know the statistics, romance novels are huge,
right,
and they continue to be extremely popular. And I think that's because people are always looking for that heart-clutching feeling in the text that I felt when I was 12 or 13 years old and still appreciate very much.
You reminded me of something when you were describing this. I had a friend who was reading 50 Shades of Grey. Now, I have not read. Have either of you read it?
No.
I have indeed read it.
I have not read it, but her husband asked me, what are you reading? She goes, it's terrible. It's awful. But she couldn't put it. It's awful. Of course, she went on to read the next one.
I stopped after one. That was plenty.
Yeah,
but,
yeah. It doesn't sound like my cup of tea.
I will add that my 95-year-old mother-in-law, rest in peace, was reading 50 Shades of Grey 2 summers ago and hiding it under the tissue box so the grandchildren wouldn't find it. And I believe she read 3 of them.
Oh, my goodness.
Before finally she ran out of steam.
All right, let's move on to history. What have you got for history?
Oh, my goodness. Well, now, even I, who can find these things, sniff these things out, was very surprised to find this book. But in thinking about it, it made perfect sense. And it's called The Love Charm of Bombs, Restless Lives in the Second World War. And it's brand new. And the author is a lecturer in English and Medical Humanities at King's College London. And what he does is it's by Laura Feigl, F-E-I-G-E-L. And what she does is she looks at 4 very popular writers from the early 1940s in England. Graham Greene, who many of us know, Rose Macaulay, Henry York, who also wrote under the name Henry Greene, and Hilda Spiel. And she follows their experiences through their letters and diaries and things like that through the London Blitzkrieg, through the bombings, and finds something that they all wrote about in their letters and that we've sort of seen in popular movies, is that people's emotions were heightened under the danger of life and death of minute to minute. And in fact, how they acted out some of this heightened emotion were through affairs, love affairs. And all of these writers had love affairs, even though they were still close to their families, many of whom had been moved out of the city for their own safety. So those who were left behind were people who had a reason to stay in London, either defiance of the Germans, but more likely a job in government, ambulance driving, firefighting. Everyone had these sort of civil or civic jobs that they were doing. And these writers were too. They were writing propaganda. They were doing a lot of other things. And all of them participated in in affairs, and the people around them did too. And now it's kind of a popular trope in World War II movies, you know, the, you know, falling in love in the subway while the bombs are raining down, this kind of thing. But in fact, in real life, this happened a lot. And people saw it as a time of sort of where their nerves were on edge and their emotions were right on the surface because they were under this enormous strain and everywhere one around them was too. And so that's how they found this, you know, whatever short-term solace, whatever you want to call it. I imagine at some point there'll be a book saying how it all came back together in 1945 when they were no longer under threat and the men came home from the front and the families came home from the countryside and that kind of thing. But this is an interesting story because I don't remember ever seeing anything quite like it before. Certainly we have a lot of fiction,
right,
you know, set in this way, but I don't think I've ever seen anyone do a nonfiction book, a history book about how people channeled these energies and emotions into love, into a form of love.
What's your history book?
Well, I have a book which is part travel book, part history book. It's really the love of a city as much as anything. But in the love of that city, there's a lot of history. It's called Cool Gray City of Love, 49 Views of San Francisco by Gary Camilla. And he was talking in an interview about what it was that he was trying to do with this book. And one of the things he says is that he is a passionate lover of San Francisco and have written about it for Salon and San Francisco Examiner. I was always thinking about it and came up with a rough idea for it years before I did it. I was thinking about approaching the city from a variety of different perspectives, scientifically, sociology, a cubist approach, if you will. But a little over 3 years ago, I decided it was time to do this project, and that's when I hit upon the idea of each of the chapters being a separate essay on a different location. So what this book contains is actually really brief little chapters with specific addresses. So if you were of a mind to, you could traverse all of San Francisco with this book. But within that, there is a lot of history because any place has a lot of history that's connected with the country's history. So, for example, one of the sections is about Haight-Ashbury. So it talks about how that all came about. And what he writes is you could choose 100 sites in the Haight to epitomize the hippie era. But unlike the Beats, whose rebellious noir spirit comes to life in darkened streets, the site cannot be urban. The corner of Haight and Ashbury does not evoke the spirit of the 60s anymore now than it did when busloads of gawkers drove past it with Richard Brautigan holding up a mirror to the windows. The hippie era needs open skies, so it's better to wander into Golden Gate Park, and talks about that. So it is really an interesting look at this very big city, and it is not really a history book per se, but it is sort of a lot of little bits of history that result in a bigger picture of the city and of the country and what happens. And he also is a very lovely writer. And if you don't like any particular spot he's talking about,
go to the next chapter
because you can use it as your guidebook. You could be reading this and writing, you know, I have to go here, I have to go here, as you read through.
Right. Oh, we have one more in the history category.
We do. And it's called Swoon: Great Seducers and Why Women Love Them by Betsy Priolo. And this is also a new book. And she is a scholar in residence at NYU. I don't remember people writing these kind of things when I was in grad school at all.
I like the title.
They're having a lot more fun. And this book talks about various historic characters, Casanova, Don Juan, those kinds of characters, and why we're attracted to them. And she also digs out all kinds of sort of the pop culture of its day, famous men in the 19th century who were considered real seducers, and then talks about what they had going for them, which is almost nothing. One of them, she talks about, he was not attractive, and he didn't have any money, and he really, the only thing he had really going for him was that he really loved women. And that's funny. She makes a list here that says, what makes a seducer? And first thing off is charisma. So they have to have a reason for you to be attracted to them. And a certain something, elan, which I think is what the Dos Equis commercial, the man who doesn't drink very often, but when he, stay thirsty, my friend, kind of thing. A certain intensity. And one of the quotes in the book is that all relationships start with an impact. So intensity is an important quality. Sex drive, of course, you know. Love of women is right up there. Androgyny is up there. Creativity is up there. Character, social IQ. She actually quotes Daniel Goleman, I think his name is, who writes the social IQ books. And self-realization, someone who knows themselves really well and can then allow other people to know themselves in that context. But it's really interesting. The story is as old as time, she writes under the section on courage. The princess lies comatose in a haunted palace under an evil spell. Men perish in the attempt to rescue her until one day two princes come along with their younger brother, Simpleton. At the palace, they find a gray dwarf who tells them they must perform three impossible tasks to break the spell. As his two craven brothers fail and turn to stone, Simpleton boldly sets off into the forest. With the aid of the beasts he befriends, he collects 1,000 pearls, dives to the bottom of the lake, finds the key to the princess's bedroom, and picks the right princess out of a choice of three. Simpleton isn't simple. He knows a cardinal lady killer truth. Only the good and brave deserve the fair. And the whole book is like that. And it's really interesting because, you know, when you read it, and, you know, I think that most women have an appreciation for these kind of men, even though you don't want to spend a lot of time with them. But when they're there in front of you, it's fun because they do appreciate you for who you are and what you are. And now, of course, you move on to a deeper realism in your life than those kinds of people. But I think she's tapped into a vein that all of us recognize.
We're talking about books on love with Melanie Lowers, books editor at the Cape Cod Times, and Jill Erickson, reference librarian at Falmouth Public Library. We'll have more after a quick break.